Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the arguments before the Supreme Court today in a case brought by conservative activists representing a few California teachers who consider paying union dues an infringement on their First Amendment rights, an argument the court's majority of conservative justices appeared ready to rule in favor of and thus deal public sector unions a severe blow. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who was in the Supreme Court today, joins us to discuss this politically charged case that appears to be aimed at decimating unions that tend to support Democratic candidates. Then, ahead of this week's inauguration of Guatemala's president-elect, the comedian Jimmy Morales, we will examine the fates of 18 former senior military and intelligence officers arrested on charges related to the massacres and disappearances of 245,000 mostly indigenous Guatemalans in the 1980s. Anita Isaacs, a professor of political science at Haverford College and author of the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala, joins us to discuss the looming showdown between the judiciary and the political establishment as prosecutors moved to have the congressional immunity of the co-founder of Morales' party lifted. Then finally, we'll go to Berlin, Germany, to speak with Stephanie Lohaus, the co-founder and co-editor of Missy magazine, Witzerek, a prominent feminist activist and author of Because an Outcry is Not Enough. Together, they have an article at Vice magazine, Immigrants Aren't Responsible for Rape Culture in Germany. And we will discuss the backlash to the 200 alleged sexual assaults that took place around Cologne's train station during New Year's celebrations that have one-third of Germans now saying their views on immigrants have worsened. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And you're in the court this morning, the Supreme Court this morning, Elizabeth, where the case of Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association was argued before the justices. And, of course, the caveat we always have in these conversations we have about when you witness these important cases is that you have no idea how the justices are going to vote based upon the questions they asked. But given that caveat, how did it look to you? Because there's a lot at stake here for public employee unions around the country, that if this handful of teachers, this eight people involved, are able to win the case, it would basically, most analysts say, it would basically decimate public sector unions.
Yeah, so the case is a very important case that raises important issues involving the First Amendment, but as you said, really implicates the ability of hardworking Americans to come together through unions to advocate for fair wages, safe workplaces, and many other important aspects of our day-to-day work life. You know, unions are sort of one of these last remaining tools for the little guy to make his or her voice heard against big corporate interests. And I would note that, you know, while the case is brought, you know, Rebecca Friedrichs, the California teacher, is sort of the named lead plaintiff, it is brought by the Center for Individual Rights on behalf of Ms. Friedrichs and nine other California teachers and the Christian Educators Association International. And the Center for Individual Rights is funded by several conservative foundations, including those affiliated with big corporate interests like the Koch brothers. So, you know, I think this case is about unions, and it is about sort of the voice of hardworking Americans versus the voice of big corporate interests, something that we've seen play out time after time in the Roberts Court. And I guess I left the court this morning a little discouraged, as I often am in the Roberts Court, when you have questions of the voice of the little guy versus big business, because the Roberts Court has consistently been ruling in favor of big business, and this is the most business-friendly court of the modern era. And this morning, unfortunately, was not terribly different. Most of the conservative justices seem to think that it's unconstitutional under the First Amendment for public sector unions to require what's called a fair share fee, which is basically a requirement that all employees covered by a particular union, and in California, like many other states, in public workplaces, there is a requirement that there's only one union, and that union bargains on behalf of everyone, whether they're a member or not. And so these fair share fees basically just say, you know, you have to contribute, even if you choose not to be a member of the union, for those collective bargaining activities that cover everyone in the workplace and are for everyone's benefits, like wage and hours. You know, and these can be things that are as mundane as, you know, how many minutes you get for your lunch break, but are very important in the lives of daily workers. And so there's been a challenge to these fair share fees under the First Amendment. And conservatives have really been pushing this because they do think that it could undermine the ability of labor unions to really be effective in the workplace.
And the 1977 decision, Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, that's the precedent that could be changed. And that was, of course, Abood came up a lot in the discussions today in the Supreme Court.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the main principles that the Supreme Court operates under is the idea that when the court has decided a case, it follows that precedent. This is a principle called stare decisis, is the Latin for it. And generally, in order to overrule an existing precedent, and particularly a precedent that goes back to 1977, you need to have a really, really, really good reason. And, you know, even though I'm a little discouraged after leaving court this morning, I didn't really hear a really good reason. You know, I think perhaps the underlying reason, which the lawyer for the challengers of the unions, Michael Carvin, noted in an interview that played this morning on NPR, that, you know, hey, he noted that labor unions are one of the biggest contributors to Democrats, and so given that these folks are conservative, that might have something to do with this. But you need to have a really good reason to overrule precedent in the Supreme Court. And the Abood case, as you mentioned, has been around since 1977. There are many states across the country that have relied on Abood to arrange their public workplaces. Unions have negotiated contracts with this in mind. There are a lot of what we call reliance interests on Abood. And looking to the Constitution, there just isn't a basis in the First Amendment's text or history for saying that unions can't ask for fair share fees to cover collective bargaining activities. And I would note that those activities are distinct from what might be considered the political activities of a union. That, under the First Amendment, you can't require employees to contribute to, because that is compelling political speech. But the court noted that it does make sense to say that everyone should chip in when the union is negotiating on their behalf for things like, you know, wage and hour and safety negotiations and contracts. And that's really what Abood is all about. And that's what this case was all about. But unfortunately, some of the conservative justices did not seem to be terribly swayed by that argument about why it's important for the court to respect precedent, even though many of them, notably Chief Justice Roberts, in his confirmation hearing before he actually got on the bench, made a big deal about the need to do so.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, Elizabeth. I remember John Roberts' confirmation hearings, and he kept talking about stare decisis. It's the first time I've heard of it, and did make a big deal out of it, that would be, you know, what he used the baseball analogy, didn't he?
Right.
That he'd be the umpire?
Yeah, he would only call balls and strikes. That was the and one of the ways that I guess you determine the strike zone is through, you know, if you're dealing with the Constitution, it's text and history, and Supreme Court precedent. And here you have precedent that goes back decades saying that these fair share fees for unions are constitutional, and there's nothing in the text or history of the First Amendment that says that unions can't require these fair share fees. And one thing that I think it's important to note when we're talking about this case, because I think a lot of people might say, well, the government can't force me to subsidize a political view that I don't agree with. And that's right. But two things that I think are important to keep in mind. One is that these fair share fees don't go to the more explicitly political activities of unions. They go to the activities that unions engage in to bargain for benefits to workers. And two, the Supreme Court has a line of cases that makes clear that when we're talking about the government as an employer, you know, there are many, many public employees, and the government's relationship as an employer to these employees is different when we're talking about free speech than when the government is acting as, you know, a sovereign and you are relating to the government as a citizen. So the court has made clear that the First Amendment, when you were talking about the government as an employer, treats the government more like a private employer. And that's important here because it means that there is less strict scrutiny under the First Amendment when it comes to government regulating its workplaces. And the court has acknowledged before, even conservative Justice Scalia has acknowledged that the government has an interest in arranging public workplaces in an efficient manner. And it makes sense that you would only want to negotiate with a single union, with a single bargaining representative for all of those public employees. I mean, imagine how tied up our government would get as a public employer if it had to negotiate a contract with every single one of the teachers in California, with every single one of the public employees. That would really hamstring the government's ability to function effectively. And Scalia noted that this morning, actually, in argument. He said, you know, I get that the government has an interest in bargaining with a single representative, but he seems skeptical that taking out these fair share fees for unions would be so debilitating, even though we've seen in the past when there weren't the ability, when there wasn't the ability to collect fair share fees, that there were problems, there were frequent strikes, even labor unrest that led to violence. And so these fair share fees have really been an important way that in many states the labor movement has created a very safe, productive environment for workers that helps the government function more effectively.
But how much, though, is this about ideology? You've mentioned, first of all, let's start with Rebecca Friedrich. She's a veteran Orange County public school teacher, but my understanding is she's also a conservative anti-union activist. The attorney that argued before the Supreme Court on behalf of these teachers, just 10 teachers all told out of a union involving hundreds of thousands, Michael Carvin, is a prominent conservative who twice argued for striking down President Obama's health care law. And the umbrella under which they've been funded is a conservative group of judicial activists getting their funding from big corporate donors and conservative donors like the Koch brothers. So, and then there's also the element of the Christian educators who I believe are advocates of homeschooling. And that, to me, really does bring in the First Amendment issue, if this is how they're trying to argue that this is about free speech. Because if a science teacher decided, a conservative Christian science teacher decided that they didn't want to teach evolution, they will argue, well, that would violate my free speech rights if I was compelled to do so. And that's an area where, God help us if we have to go down that road.
You know, it's certainly, if they were trying to make this case out to be something other than a conservative advocacy movement, then they didn't do a very good job of choosing their, you know, their lawyer. Certainly, as you note, Michael Carvin is very prominently affiliated with the challenges to the Affordable Care Act. You know, the folks behind the law certainly seem to be part of the conservative legal movement. You know, I think one of the tactics of the case is to focus on some of the more controversial issues involving teachers and education policy. But so much of what unions do and so much of what will be impacted by this ruling are much more routine employment matters that are important to the day-to-day lives of workers, procedures for taking leave, safety of various workplaces, processing employee grievances. These are not political aspects of public employment. They're important for the day-to-day conditions that workers find when they go to work, and that's an important part of what unions do for Americans and has been an important part of the labor movement. And I think that by making this case come from teachers, there's a focus on these more kind of abstract, hot-button issues, when what we're talking about here is, you know, if you take this into the context of firefighters or law enforcement, impacting the ability of public sector unions in those cases could be very serious, because unions sometimes provide benefits to workers, which then benefit the public, that the workplaces themselves can't provide, like training for firefighters or equipment that is very important. And so I think we could see some very negative consequences if the court rules to strike down the important Abood precedent, not just for the court's legitimacy as an institution, which that stare decisis problem that we talked about earlier, Justice Breyer openly worried in court this morning that it could damage the court's reputation as sort of an anchor of stability in a changing world if they just, you know, willy-nilly struck down precedent. So I think there are negative consequences potentially of a bad decision in this case for the public, certainly for public sector employees, and even potentially for the legitimacy of the Supreme Court.
But just in closing, though, Elizabeth Wydra, when Justice Scalia, who basically said that, quoting him, "the problem is that everything that is bargained for with the government is within the political sphere," you know, that strikes me as being incredibly disingenuous, because it's basically the conservative movement in this country, which he is certainly a champion of, Scalia and the other justices, they're the ones who have made an issue that government is evil, government is the problem. They have politicized the very nature of government. You know, it never used to be, as far as I know, that, you know, that if you work for the government or for a state government, as a teacher does, that you are somehow involved in some political activities. You're a public servant. And in fact, these justices themselves arguably are public servants. At least the judiciary is considered a public servant. So it just strikes me that there's something quite dishonest about all of this.
Well, it certainly wants to take the government out of its role as a significant employer and into sort of this hypercharged political sphere, when that's really not the, you know, I think if you talk to folks who are public servants, whether they're law enforcement officers or teachers, you know, most of what they're doing every day is not necessarily these hot button issues. They're out there serving the public interest, but not in a political way. And so much of what unions do in the public sector is these, you know, more routine, mundane activities that have nothing to do with these more hot button issues. And it's also, in some ways, very inconsistent, because the conservative justices were in favor of a ruling about a decade ago, actually coming out of Los Angeles, where there was a deputy district attorney for the LA County District Attorney's Office, and he wrote a memo critical of a search warrant that he thought was inaccurate, and he was fired because of that. And the Supreme Court, these conservative justices who now want to say that the government has no ability to structure its workplace in the way they think best, in that case, they said it was totally fine that this objecting district attorney was fired, because the First Amendment did not protect him in that case, because he was acting as an employee and didn't have First Amendment protections in that particular context, because the government was acting as an employer and not as the government relating to a citizen. So, you know, it's very inconsistent here, and I think that will be problematic for the Supreme Court if they do strike down Abood and make it much harder for public sector unions to continue to advocate for hardworking Americans.
And that's basically your fear that they're going to do that, right?
You know, I am a cautious optimist. Right. You know, there was a case in 2014, Harris versus Quinn, that raised the same issue, and the court stopped short of overruling Abood in that case. You know, that's not that long ago, 2014. We're 2016 now, but still not much has changed since then. So that gives me a little bit of hope that maybe the court will not actually take the step off the cliff this time. But as I noted, I am an optimist by nature. So, you know, you can take that with whatever, how many grains of salt you think you need to.
Well, Elizabeth Wydra, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the arrests of 18 former senior military and intelligence officers in Guatemala on charges of disappearances and genocide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anita Isaacs, who's a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College and the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador, At War with the Past, and the forthcoming The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. She has a recent op-ed at the New York Times, A Wrong Turn for Guatemalan Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anita Isaacs.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And this week, on January the 14th, the comedian Jimmy Morales is being inaugurated as the next president of Guatemala. But at the same time, 14 senior military and intelligence officers were just charged on Wednesday with charges related to the massacres and disappearances during the 1980s of about 245,000, mostly indigenous Guatemalans. So you seem to have a two-track system going here, where you've got this comedian who was elected in an election that followed a massive protest by hundreds of thousands of citizens against the corrupt ruler, but none of the elections themselves that followed that elected the comedian weren't really representative of the entire electorate. And it seems like the judiciary has been emboldened now to move against the previously protected group of senior military and intelligence officers who perpetrated these massacres and disappearances.
Yeah, I think it's even more closely connected, however. Several of the closest associates and indeed the founders of the party for whom Jimmy Morales, the incumbent president, ran as the standard bearer, are connected with the most reactionary, repressive, and brutal wing of the armed forces who were active during Guatemala's very long internal armed conflict. So many of those, either directly or indirectly, implicated in the arrests last week, and I think we're up to 18 officers now, have links to the party and the retired officers association that supports the party. In fact, there's one member of Congress, an elected deputy, often viewed during the campaign as standing right beside the incoming president, for whom the Department of the Ministry of Justice has demanded that his immunity be stripped so that he can face trials for these same offenses for which the other sort of 18 officers so far have been arrested. And so it's very, very close to sort of the judicial branch and the political branch are really getting very close to each other in a confrontational, in a potentially confrontational way.
And you're referring there to Edgar Justino Ovalle, who is a member and the co-founder of the party that Jimmy Morales got elected on. It was a, I mean, am I correct in suggesting that this was a sort of a party that the establishment sort of quickly cobbled together to keep the oligarchical rule going? And in those last elections, the will of the hundreds of thousands of people who demonstrated and that brought down the corrupt government that preceded Jimmy Morales, in effect, didn't have a candidate that they could vote for.
Yes, to a significant degree. Let me see how to put this simply. The party that was founded by these ex-military officers, and you're absolutely right, including Ovalle, the now elected deputy minister, in Congress, was actually sort of a party bereft of a leadership. And they actually co-opted or approached Jimmy Morales and tried to get him and encouraged him to become the standard bearer of the party. So that was sort of the effort by retired military officers, their organization and their party, to find a potential leader. Meanwhile, the oligarchy, which has long had a partnership of sorts with the military, found in Jimmy Morales the candidate, the potential candidate that they could imagine dealing with. They found the two front runners at the time completely objectionable. And so Jimmy Morales, as a fresh face, became the possible candidate that could appeal to them. And they also felt that his inexperience, he has no political experience whatsoever, would be to their advantage because they would be able to mold him and form him and basically, you know, run politics from behind the scenes or as his ministers. So it was a meeting of minds in which the military basically took control and negotiated their share of interests and power, which was to govern, to have control over national security issues, while the economic elites were jumped on Jimmy's bandwagon with the aim of controlling economic and financial policy.
So then in terms of the people that were arrested, going back to the massacres of the 1980s, a number of them, of course, like Rios Montt, he's already been on trial, and he's basically, his lawyers have been managed to have him avoid, I think they're using the rubric that he suffers from dementia, but the others, some of them, when they were arrested on their perp walks, were in tears, saying that they only killed for the country, they didn't kill innocent people, which history indicates to be completely untrue. So when all of these characters that are responsible for this bloody war, if indeed this collision that you referred to between the judiciary and the political forces in the country, assuming that justice prevails in that forthcoming clash, what about the American politicians who encouraged, if not turned a blind eye to these massacres in the name of anti-communism? People like Elliot Abrams, for example, in the Reagan administration.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, there are lots of points to make in that regard. Yes, I mean, I think that the United States has very dirty hands in the Guatemalan conflict, and it is likely that as these trials move forward, that we're going to hear a lot more about U.S. involvement. At the same time, U.S. involvement was somewhat less direct than in El Salvador, where the U.S. were, which was really U.S.'s other Vietnam. In the case of Guatemala, there was silent approval. There was approval for Rios Montt. There was a resumption of military aid. But there was, at some point, things were so horrific. The abuses were so awful that at some point, the U.S. really distanced themselves somewhat from the Guatemalan regime. So it's not entirely clear how much will be exposed through this. The U.S. has always said that it is not responsible for reparations for the atrocities committed during Guatemala's armed conflict. And I think that that might be an interesting set of issues that emerge as transitional justice indeed seems to move forward. In terms of, if I could go back to one thing to sort of that you correctly mentioned, that these officers deny having been involved in killing civilians, just to mention that the majority of these officers have been arrested for crimes associated with 3 years of exhumations or the digging up of bones on a military base in the country. And they've dug up over 550 human remains, and many of those are, in fact, of women and children. So it's going to be very hard for these officers to make any serious claim that they are not responsible for committing massive human rights violations against innocent civilians.
And the peace accords that brought an end to this 36-year civil war in 1996, is that body that brought about the end of that war, is it still active? And was there a provision in the peace accords to keep the possibility of prosecutions open? Or was there immunity given? Because obviously, I imagine there wasn't immunity given because the prosecutors have been able to go after them. But has that made it difficult for the prosecutors, whatever conditions were brought about to end that war?
Yeah. Well, there was a law of national reconciliation that was signed right before signing the official peace accord, sort of the final peace accord. And that accord granted immunity from prosecution for all crimes that were political and with the exception of crimes of forced disappearance, torture, and genocide. And the crimes for which these officers are now being charged have to do with forced disappearances as well as torture, but forced disappearances because it is the bodies that were dug up at this military base are bodies of people who were disappeared, as we say, who were kidnapped from their communities and taken to the military base.
But in terms of genocide, which is one of the provisions you mentioned, my understanding is that of the 245,000 Guatemalans who died in the Civil War, weren't the majority of those indigenous people?
Yes, 83% of the victims of the armed conflict were indigenous people.
So how could that not be genocidal?
Well, you know, Okay, that's a tough question for me because I believe that it was genocide. I am convinced that the army targeted the indigenous Mayan population because they believed, for two reasons. First of all, they believed as much of non-indigenous society has historically believed that indigenous Guatemalans are less than full humans and citizens. But secondly, they targeted them because they, as part of a counterinsurgency strategy, they felt that that the guerrillas had their base among the Guatemalan population, in the rural highlands where indigenous people live, and if the indigenous population wasn't sympathetic to the guerrillas or actively engaged with the guerrillas now, so if they were children or children to be born or women, that someday those children to be born could grow up to be guerrillas. And on that basis, they sought to eradicate entire communities. So it does constitute genocide in the sense of directly targeting an ethnic community. It doesn't matter what the reasons for that are. They are targeting them on the basis of their ethnicity. That has been, you know, a highly challenged concept. It's very difficult. It has been always very difficult to prove genocide. Genocide is this kind of concept that is very open to interpretation, actually. And so it is going to be easier to find these officers guilty for crimes of torture and forced disappearance than it will be for crimes of genocide. That's just the reality of it.
Well, Anita Isaacs, I thank you very much for joining us. And I take it we have to stay tuned here and hope that justice prevails in a country that's been pretty much, as long as I can remember, being ruled by a combination of a military junta and oligarchs who, as you just pointed out, have very little regard for the human lives of most of their indigenous people.
Yes, I guess that I would thank you very much for having me. Just in leaving, I would say that my op-ed in November was titled A Wrong Turn for Guatemalan Democracy, but I also am feeling at the moment more optimistic about Guatemala with this news than I felt in an awfully long time. So thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you again. I've been speaking with Anita Isaacs, who's a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College and the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador, At War with the Past, and the forthcoming Politics of Transitional Justice in Post-War Guatemala. She also has a recent op-ed at the New York Times, A Wrong Turn for Guatemalan Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back and go to Berlin, Germany, to talk about the backlash to the alleged sexual assaults that took place around Cologne's train station during New Year's celebrations. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Berlin, Germany, is Anne Witzerich, who is a digital media consultant, author, speaker, and blogger. She's a prominent feminist activist based in Berlin and is the author of Because an Outcry is Not Enough. And in 2013, she began the Outcry hashtag, which started a debate on the subject of everyday sexism in Germany. She, along with Stephanie Lohaus, have an article at Vice magazine, Immigrants Aren't Responsible for Rape Culture in Germany. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne Witzerich.
Thank you for having me.
And obviously since the 200 or so alleged sexual assaults on New Year's around the Cologne railway station, there has been, over the weekend, right-wing demonstrations and counter-demonstrations. The Angela Merkel has been forced to clarify her position on immigrants, and in general it seems to have ignited a fairly fierce debate, and indeed apparently in recent polls there indicates that about a third of Germans have now changed their minds over accepting refugees. So where do you think this is heading? Is there a serious debate going on, or is this a sort of, you know, nativism and racism emerging as we have here in our political culture and in our political season with presidential candidates like Donald Trump emerging and dominating the discourse?
Yeah, so like you said, the debate is very heated. And the one thing that I think is positive about it that is that we're actually talking about sexism and sexual violence again, because every feminist knows that this is not something we do every day, although it's a serious problem also in Germany. I mean, here we have numbers like every third woman has been either experiencing physical or sexual violence in her life. So that's also been the numbers before we had a lot of immigrants coming to Germany. So although that is a number that is there, and a lot of studies prove that sexual violence is still a problem here, we don't talk about it as much as we should. So talking about it now is actually a good thing, but the way that we do it is not focusing on how we actually could help survivors of sexual assault and even, for example, build a better infrastructure of crisis centers, of counseling centers and stuff like that, and changing laws that need to be changed in order to make it possible to bring perpetrators to justice. So now, the right wing is actually using these stories and these experiences the people had in Cologne in order to set their racist agenda, and I think that's a huge problem.
And also joining us from Berlin is Stephanie Lohaus, who's the co-founder and co-editor of Missy magazine and a freelance journalist and author who writes and lectures on feminism and pop culture. She, along with Anne Wisarek, have an article at Vice magazine, Immigrants Aren't Responsible for Rape Culture in Germany. And Stephanie, given that 31 suspects have been taken in for questioning following the incidents at the Cologne around the Cologne railway station on New Year's night, where I believe alcohol was a big factor in what happened there, more than half of them were apparently asylum seekers. So in terms of your article, who is responsible then, I mean, in this case?
Well, responsible is the perpetrator, as always. I mean, what we don't want to do is say the people responsible are not responsible, you know. I mean, you always have to, I mean, they even though they are, you have to analyze the reasons why violence happened, why perpetrators become perpetrators, you still have to take them responsible, of course.
Sure.
That's how it works.
Well, I understand.
All we were saying is that it's not only, I mean, you know, like not only Muslim cultures or Indian cultures or, you know, I mean, it was a reaction to the notion that all the other cultures that are not Western have rape culture. We are saying, well, I mean, the whole incident happened in Germany, so it was German police that was there that didn't notice or didn't react properly. You know, it's German law that's really too soft on this sort of sexual violence. It's stuff like this. So we're putting it into context.
Sure.
We're not saying don't blame them.
Right. I understand. But well, for example, I believe the sexual assaults and rapes happen every year in Germany at Oktoberfest. An average of 10 reported rapes take place each year. The estimated number of the unreported cases is something like 200. And you mentioned India, Mumbai, there have been a series of rapes. And what role, though, is alcohol? I mean, it sounds a little bit like a combination of, you know, soccer hooliganism as well as a rape here.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I would say alcohol definitely did play a role. I don't know. What do you think, Anna? Did alcohol play a role?
I'm pretty sure. I mean, if you look at other incidents of sexual assault that happened in public, it's usually big events with a huge crowd. It's not easy to spot incidents like this just right away. And alcohol also loosens up people and makes them, helps them to do things they wouldn't usually do. So I think that's also a factor that needs to be considered here.
But I also, again, think it's very important. I mean, in Germany, if you're drunk, I don't know how the laws are in the U.S., if you commit a crime drunk, they say it's not as much. It's an excuse, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't know what you were doing or something.
Sure.
So, I mean, we still have to be careful not to use all these things as excuses, but as explanations.
Sure. Well, I come from Australia where getting drunk is considered an honorable activity. So I understand what you're saying. But let's talk about the political fallout here. I mentioned that more than one-third of Germans in a recent poll have said their view of foreigners have worsened following this spate of 200 alleged sexual assaults over New Year's at the Cologne railway station. And this has called into question Angela Merkel's open-door policy and the slogan that we can do it. Germany, of course, has gotten an enormous amount of praise around the world, and particularly in contrast to, say, Hungary, in the treatment of this massive humanitarian catastrophe coming out of the Middle East, in particular Syria. So at this point, where would both of you put the situation in terms of compassion versus xenophobia?
Well, I think it's really interesting what's happening in Germany since a couple of months, because so many people I know, or at least here in Berlin, not only in Berlin, everywhere in Germany, take in refugees and are helping newcomers and are really aware, and for the first time, I think, in their lives are meeting, you know, people from the Middle East, Muslims, and all the stereotypes that are, you know, we grow up with since we're kids, you know. I mean, we had a big migration of Turkish people from the 60s on, and they were always the stereotypes we all grew up with. And now I think a lot of people are challenging those stereotypes. And so at the same time as this happens, I think it's really, I think those people who maybe are not involved in this, they're not going through this process, but many other people are. So I think that, I think actually the society is splitting up more into different groups. This is actually what scares me a bit. But I don't see that all of the Germans will, you know, more and more become scared of the newcomers.
And Stephanie Lohaus, you did you grow up in a neighborhood that had a lot of Turkish immigrants?
It was very mixed. I didn't grow up in a specific, I mean, I come from the Ruhrgebiet, mm-hmm. which is a very industrial area, and it has coal mining. So there were very many guest workers, as we used to call them, which meant they will go home, but they never did. And there were some kids, but it was not, I mean, what happened in the 60s, because they were considered guest workers, it's different from the United States, but still they were sort of put in certain areas close to the coal mines, like working areas. So it was a little bit like a ghetto, but really not comparable what you have in the States. But where I lived, it was a bit, it was mixed. I mean, from my hometown actually come lots of fighters for the IS, Islamic State, Dienstlaken. It was in the news.
Well, let me ask Anne Vizarek about this idea of guests staying on. And we, of course, it's very much a political issue here brought up by Donald Trump, who wants to, and along with a number of the Republican presidential candidates, want to deport at least 11 million Mexican and Central and South American immigrants that are living here in the shadows in the way that perhaps some of the guest workers in Germany are. I'm not totally privy to the information about how the system works in Germany, but here it's becoming increasingly difficult for immigrants to become legal once they've made an illegal entry, or what's considered an illegal entry. Now, I have noticed, though, news reports that immigrant communities, particularly from the Middle East in Germany, have reacted to what happened, and they're very, very upset and deeply ashamed of these activities. So is there a noticeable stigmatization happening since this New Year's event?
That's really the sad thing about it, because just last night we had a news story that people were meeting over meeting over Facebook and making sure to meet at a certain place in Cologne and to hunt, actually, for people of color. So we already see the results of the racist notion of the debate that we're currently having.
And have you any information about how immigrant families are dealing with this, particularly those that have lived in Germany a long time? If Turkish immigrants have been coming since the 1960s, there are several generations now, I imagine. And how much have they integrated into German life?
We're both not from this background.
So,
do you want to say something? I don't know. I have to think about it a little bit.
Okay.
Well, I think the problem with German integration politics is that they're still not really about integration. It's still about this kind of, as long as you don't totally behave like the Germans who are white, you can never be actually German. I mean, we have people here, like you said, for several generations. They have maybe migrant parents, but they're born here and they're not white. And they're still being treated as non-German, and that is a problem. I mean, that also is still a cause for people of color, like with a name that indicates that they have foreign roots. They still have problems when they apply for jobs. Some of them even still don't get like a certain kind of job, and will never get like the high level ones. And so I think it's closely connected to a lower social status. So it's just now with the current generation that more people of color are having more powerful positions, for example, in politics. But it's still not a regular thing. It's still an exception. So I think we have some sort of in between status. Like some people are examples of good integration, so to speak, and they will be held up high, and the other ones are being treated as, well, they didn't try hard enough, whereas it's being ignored that not all people of color have the same opportunities as white people have in Germany.
So is this, though, the generosity that Germany is showing compared to other countries like Hungary that closed their door on this influx of immigrants literally fleeing for their lives from Syria? And here in the United States, we've had presidential candidates closing the door, calling for, in Donald Trump's case, for a complete shutting the door on any Muslims coming into the country. And most of the governors of the United States refuse to take any more immigrants. And in the president's State of the Union address tomorrow night, the First Lady is going to be seated next to some refugees from Syria. So there's no question that Germany is showing more compassion than most countries. But on the other hand, it's a country that I believe has a very low birth rate and needs workers. And so how much of this is practical and how much of it is compassion and generosity?
Yeah, well, I would say it's a combination. I mean, I don't know if Germans are especially compassionate compared to others, but I think what I was thinking about this, and I think that two things that happened in German history that are important now, and one is that very many families have a story of migration themselves, because after the Second World War, for example, my grandparents from my mother's side, they came from Russia and Poland, and they had to leave the countries. So I have a story of refuge in my family that deeply affected my mother and, I mean, you know, the family through generations. So I know sort of I don't really know what it feels like, but I know the stories from my grandmother. And also in the 90s, during the war in Yugoslavia, Germany also took in very many refugees, I think 1 million or 800,000, something like this. And so, I mean, I remember, for example, that I gave school lessons for kids back then. I was, I don't know, 15, so there is already, and it was not, I mean, it was totally different. There was not this panic, you know. I mean, there were Muslims also, but it was not the narrative at all, you know. It was very close. I mean, it was Yugoslavia, it was Europe. So I think that this is why maybe more people feel feel, yeah, confident that it's possible to help those people. And of course, it does have a practical side, I would say. I mean, I'm not sure if it works. If you look at migration studies, they say that you cannot compensate a low birth rate completely by migration, but a little bit maybe, but the birth rate is so low, it won't make such a big difference. But I mean, this is also, on the other hand, it brings in fear because, you know, low-skilled workers might be scared that they lose their jobs or that people come who work for lower wages and stuff. There was a debate about cutting minimum wage and stuff like this. So,
well, let me give Anne Vicerek the last word here. We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Anne, about the declaration that you've made today related to your outcry hashtag. What are you trying to do?
Yeah, so we gathered 22 intersectional feminists, and we're all activists, so we wanted to make a change. And we issued a statement today that we don't accept this narrative. We won't accept that feminism and feminist ideas will be exploited in order to push forward with a racist agenda. And we also have 14 demands of how we can actually tackle the problem of sexism and sexual assault in our society, not just ours, but patriarchal societies in general. And this ranges from being as a person, you're like a private person, you can take a stand by using bystander intervention, for example, when you become aware of a sexual assault situation, that you intervene, but also how the media has a huge responsibility, for example, in terms of what kind of language they use when they talk about rape, for example, that it's a sex attack. That is not the case. Rape is never about sex. It's about power, and this must be reflected in the language and also in the pictures that they use, and that they refrain from racist narratives when we talk about sexual assault. So, and of course, the laws we've already mentioned that need to be changed in order to make it easier for people who have been through this trauma to get justice.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Stephanie Lohaus and Anne Vicerek. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And again, bye-bye. And again, Stephanie Lohaus is the co-founder and co-editor of Missy Magazine and a freelance journalist and author who writes and lectures on feminism and pop culture. And Vicerek is a digital media consultant, author, speaker, and blogger, and a prominent feminist activist based in Berlin. She's the author of Because an Outcry is Not Enough, and in 2013, she began the Aufschrei Outcry hashtag, which started a debate on the subject of everyday sexism in Germany, and together they have an article at Vice magazine, Immigrants Aren't Responsible for Rape Culture in Germany. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.